Jane, do you want to go?
Okay. Thank you, Pat. Yeah, I think if we move on to page 4, which is a summary of the request for information that we published in March. I know certainly quite a few people in the room are familiar with the request for information because we did get quite a few responses from the people around this table, so thank you so much for doing that. For those not quite so familiar, the purpose of the request for information was really a fact-finding exercise in order for us to gain a better understanding of the types of rate regulation that are in force around the world. The previous project on rate regulation resulted in an exposure draft being issued in July 2009, which again many of you are familiar with. The area of that 2009 exposure draft that almost all of the 155 comment letters talked about was the scope of that project. And the scope of the exposure draft was for cost of service type of regulation, where the rate itself is set by taking the costs of the entity, building in a rate of return on the investment, and that gave you the rate to charge to customers. A handful of people thought that scope was too broad, which was slightly strange, but the majority, the vast majority of people thought the opposite, thought that scope was far too narrow and focused only on a very, very limited number of regulatory schemes around the world. So one of the big messages from that previous project is that to move forward, we really need to learn about the different types of regulation. So we issued the request for information in March this year. We got 79 responses to that request for information. And if you would look at the appendix to paper 4, we've just summarised where those responses come from. And you can see they come from 25 different countries, but some of those letters did talk about regulation in other countries as well, because lots of groups have subsidiaries in different parts of the world from the parent company. So we've got some information from 37 different countries, and within those countries there are several regulatory schemes described in those countries as well. So I feel that we've got some very good coverage from those different types of schemes. It highlighted that rate regulation is very common through lots of different industries. Commonly, when people are thinking rate regulation, the main utilities come to mind: electricity, gas, water. But actually, there are lots of other industries as well, and I've touched on some of them in paragraph 19 of this paper. Some of them, again, we expected, things like public transport, postal services, but there were a few others that certainly I hadn't expected. The provision of certain goods like fertilizers. In some countries, that's such an important product. Others, it's things like sugar, bread, flour. We also had one that talked about the provision of cemetery services as well, which was kind of unexpected, but it just goes to show that there are so many different things that are rate regulated. So I think one of the things that we need to do is start focusing on a lower level or a finer level of detail. Can we find something that's common to these things? Obviously looked at the types of rate regulation, bearing in mind the 2009 project, and sure enough the responses came back and showed that there are two main types of rate regulation in force. There is the cost of service regulation that we've talked about, and also there's an incentive-based regulation where the formula for the rate is focused more on the outputs rather than being built up from the inputs. That said, those are kind of two extremes, and all 79 responses described rate regulation that was somewhere in between. I didn't see any of them that were pure cost of service or pure incentive based. All of them had some combination of the two, which I think, but you're here to give me your opinions on this. I think it means that trying to define the scope of the project based on a type of regulation is going to be extremely difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly with the terminology that's used. I had several responses that said, we operate under a cost of service scheme, and then the description built in lots of incentive elements to it. Others said, we operate under an incentive-based scheme, and gave pretty much the same description as the cost of service scheme. So, it's
right.
really confusing. So I started to try and look for other elements that were common to these responses, and one thing that did strike me quite significantly is the different types of industries that were set up, that were described, all have some sort of public service or essential goods element to them. And again, I'd be interested in your views as to whether that's something that we can explore in terms of setting the scope. Things that governments feel are quite critical to make sure there's a stability of supply. Because of that public service element then, the objectives of the rate regulation are really quite complex. Lots of people, again, in the responses started out by saying the purpose of the rate regulation is to act as a substitute for competition. But again, looking at the detail, it isn't really a substitute for competition. It's far more complicated than that. And I summarised in paragraph 23 some of the general objectives of the rate regulation. And yes, it is to try and compensate for a monopoly supplier or suppliers with very dominant market position, to try and moderate the prices that they charge to customers, which is a sort of substitute for competition. But there are other elements that you wouldn't expect to find in a truly competitive market, such as trying to ensure the financial viability of the supplier and give them an expected rate of return or some reasonable or fair rate of return. Also critically, a key objective that came across in the responses is the protection of the supply, making sure that the supplier doesn't get into financial difficulties, making sure that the essential goods or the public goods and services are maintained. And then lower on paragraph, I think it's paragraph 25, sets some of the more detailed objectives of the regulation, which I've found from the responses it tends to be the more established rate regulatory schemes start to build in these additional, perhaps more subtle objectives, which are things like environmental policies, trying to improve the quality of service, the speed that outages are repaired, things like that. They just start building layers and layers of obligations, which again, you wouldn't necessarily find in a truly competitive market. From those objectives then, there are lots of obligations put on the suppliers, which I'm looking around the room at the preparers in the room. I'm sure you're aware of the obligations that you have to invest certain amounts. Usually the rate regulation builds in minimum levels of investment in the infrastructure. Changes in the type of infrastructure, again, quite often driven by the environmental issues. Also, these obligations include some restrictions on the way that you might normally trade in a competitive market, particularly because it forces you to supply goods and services to people that perhaps you wouldn't normally supply goods and services to, because they're vulnerable parts of the population, so you may have to provide goods at a cheaper rate than you would do in a truly open market. There may be, if you're looking at postal services or gas, electricity supply, you may have to spend money on putting in infrastructure in place in very remote parts of the country, where again it may not be financially the most sensible thing to do in a competitive situation. So lots and lots of obligations built in, And those obligations obviously need to have some rights to compensate for those obligations. And the most common rights that we've seen coming through in the responses are usually the right to operate and provide the goods and services in a monopoly situation or something very close to a monopoly, usually in geographical regions. Sometimes the monopoly is very explicit in either a license or a service concession arrangement, an agreement with the regulatory body. Sometimes it's a kind of natural monopoly just because of the geography or because of the physical aspects of the infrastructure that's needed or the high level of the investment that's needed. But even in those natural monopolies, there seems to be some underpinning the protection of the monopoly by some sort of regulation or legislation that's in place. In all of those cases, or in almost all of those cases, the response is said as part of that right, the regulation builds in at least the opportunity for suppliers to recover their costs and make a fair and reasonable return on the investment. The legal frameworks in place obviously differ from geography to geography, but quite a few of the responses mentioned there's been court cases to try and confirm the right of the supplier to recover costs and earn a return. Quite a few of those court cases did, though, question what's meant by prudently incurred costs, because those are usually the costs that you can recover. If you just spend money on things that are not deemed necessary, then they're not usually covered by the regulation. Also, lots of questions and court cases over what is a reasonable or a fair rate of return as well. So the return is not always guaranteed. Again, those rights and obligations vary considerably across the piece. But another common thread that came out in all of the responses was the use of variance accounts or deferral accounts or tracker accounts, different terminology for these things, but there are certain items, usually of expenditure, but sometimes of income as well, where the regulation builds in, I suppose, stronger assurances that these things will be recovered through the rate regulatory process. And again, in regimes or in schemes where it's more the pure cost of service, there tend to be more of these tracker accounts. In the more incentive-based side of the spectrum, there are fewer of these tracker accounts. But even in the most incentive-based, there are still certain costs, certain accounts, where there is a tracker put in place, and then there is some sort of mechanism to allow the recovery or reversal of that account. And those mechanisms I've summarised in paragraph 40 of the paper. Very occasionally, there is a direct cash flow. So very occasionally in certain countries, there is a process where there is retrospective billing, either to customers or to a government body, where there is a cash flow. So if you've under-recovered cost, the regulatory body or specific customers will pay cash. If you've over-recovered, you need to provide a cash refund. In those cases, you know, I think it's reasonably straightforward. There is an asset or a liability because it's a receivable or a payable that's established by that contract. But those are few and far between. The vast majority rely on changes to the future rates that are charged for the provision of future goods and services. And the length of time that's put into the reversal or the recovery can vary significantly. Certain of these costs, there will be an adjustment to the rate over a very short period. It could be automatic, so it's built into the formula that if you under or over recover by a certain margin, you immediately then put an adjustment through to the bills of the customers over the next period. You could make that adjustment as a separate line item so it's totally transparent. It may take 6 months, 12 months for that account to reverse through. Other times, though, that account will be adjusted through the general rate calculation for the next regulatory period. Those periods vary from a year through to 8 years, was the longest that I saw through the responses. And it kind of gets lost in the rate rather than being highlighted as a separate line item on the bill. Those accounts then could be reversed or recovered over a period of even 40 or 50 years, depending on the type of account that it is and the rate formula. But again, there are trackers, there are systems to carry these through. So those were really the main messages that we got from the responses to the request for information. What I'd like to do now, if it's okay with Patricia, is kind of open up the floor. Some of these issues we will discuss in more detail, obviously, in the later papers.
That's the odd one up button, so.
But I was just switches all off. I was just wondering if people had any general comments or observations, if they've got different experiences in the jurisdictions or the regulatory regimes that they're operating in.
Well, I could start just for the heck of it.
Right
over here. So I would concur that I think that the scope could be broader than simply cost of service. So I would support the notion that so you're really looking at the common thread that there is the independent statutorily based body that has the power to set the rates, change the pattern of cash flows, and create the assets and liabilities. I don't think that we need to be as narrow in scope as looking at simply cost of service. The broader definition would allow you to incorporate or completely embrace the multiplicity of entities that you noted responded to the requests for information. And wouldn't then require, I think, as we go down this path, a differentiation within standards or rules that would make things more problematic. Cost, I think, has traditionally been used by regulators because it's transparent and it's defensible as a discrete way of setting rates. It isn't the only method, which is why the incentive-based metrics have been created. And as assets become depreciated, rates tend to get decoupled from the value of the service that's being provided. And as the assets, depending on its investment profile, that decoupling can then challenge the regulator to determine what is the fair value or what should the rate be and what should the basis upon that rate, what should the basis of that rate be, meaning if it's not cost, then what should it be? And you do see that in some limited asset situations in Canada where the cost has become depreciated but the value of the service remains very high. In fact, changes over time, and there is a discontinuity between value and the cost-driven rate, and it is a subject of lengthy proceedings. So I think it is a broader approach. I think you should follow, from my perspective, the notion that it is the presence of a regulator who has the ability to authorize the creation of the asset or liability and change the timing of cash flow. And they're doing that within a statutory context, which I think is the difference between a rate-regulated entity generally and the non-rate-regulated. And again, that will capture pretty much your entire universe of those entities that have some form of statutory rate regulation. That was it.
Mary?
A brief comment, observation, kind of thinking about the range of attributes that you were describing, Jane, having seen in the paper. I think anticipating perhaps our discussion on scope here, I think it's really helpful to have the broad a range as possible of people, of entities, activities that might be considered rate regulation. I think we have to figure out what the right scope is for any any project that we take up, rather than saying we must define the scope so that it captures everything that could possibly be considered to be rate regulated. So we don't have to find the common denominator across all of them, but rather think about which ones might be the right focus for standard, level project. And part of that work will be staying in and out. So it's not automatically how do we encompass everyone we heard back from, but the fact patterns giving us a range and thinking about how we describe things so we don't inadvertently capture something we don't think should be captured.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. One or two people were concerned that they don't want to be captured by any guidance that might be produced from this. And some of it is, I think, where there's perhaps a price cap put on, but there is no link back to any costs or any specific elements of the entity itself. So I'm thinking of things like one example was where banks, when they're lending money to certain elements of the population, there's a cap on the interest rates that they're allowed to charge for those things. But it doesn't matter how profitable or unprofitable that activity is for the bank, it's just a general cap, and there's no tracker accounts used or anything like that. Another example that's in Europe at the moment is in telecommunications. The European Commission have been putting caps on the roaming charges that mobile or cell phones can charge where people go to a different country within the European Union. So again, it's a form of regulation of prices, but I'm not sure it's a type of regulation that perhaps we're looking to capture within this project.
In that vein, I wonder if you should consider also introducing the concept you talked about the essential service element, where you have a group of customers that it is virtually certain that group of customers will be using a service that is linked to one supplier. They do not have options of other suppliers, and use that as a way to start to avoid the problem that was referenced, that this gets so broad that it could conceivably touch a lot of industries that were never contemplated.
I think the difficulty with that approach, and I can think even within the electric power industry, both in the United States and in Canada, the notion of the number of suppliers to the entity, not entirely sure that would include all rate-regulated electric power companies in the U.S. or in Canada. I can think that there would be multiple suppliers of the commodity, unless you're talking solely about the distribution or transmission component of that, but we do rate regulate generation companies that do have multiple sources and sometimes with parties. So I think you're going to get into a definition issue there of what you mean by one supplier, what part of that utility value chain you're talking about. So be cautious about that type of definition.
If I may, I think, Jane, you mentioned monopoly, and I think what is key is monopoly or absence of competition. It's not that there is a kind of regulation of the market, because there is no market when I think we are for concessions or for rate-regulated. No competition, I think we've discussed in transport, power transport, grids, gas transport, grids, but maybe generation power could be regulated, but it's another regulation. It's regulation of the market. It's different for me. And when you mention regulation for telco in Europe, for example, I think it's a regulation of market, not a kind of rate-regulated activities. Because there is no competition. In fact, we didn't mention the occurrence with revenue recognition, because I understand the subject is closed, so I didn't want to open it, but I'm sorry, for me it's really a question of revenue, and we wonder when we answered the ED on revenue recognition whether rate regulated was included in the scope or not, because in fact you have a client, you have a company, but you're a regulator in the middle. So there is no direct dialogue between the client and the company, especially for the price. And even some clients, we discussed that before, that maybe they want to change to switch from power to candles, but the choice is limited. So I think it's key, and maybe that's one common feature with IFRIC 12. Even if IFRIC 12, the regulation or the tariff regulation is different because there is a limit of time in the contract, so there is a maturity, so you don't have any roll-off which is over years, as you mentioned. Even if you don't lost, what's the difference? Because you can be sure that people from the business are following what they should recover and do it. So they're not lost. I mentioned that maybe you mentioned the tracking system for business is key to recover the cost, even if it's not accounted on a balance sheet. But for me, it's really important that the client, that's why I think it's very important to have the client base, because the client base is quite captive. They have no choice. So, and when you live in Paris, you don't have any choice for the water distribution. As a client, I would say. So there is no competition. That's why it's regulated, I think. No, because it's a balance between, as Jane mentioned, between service, public service, a good service, but at a fair price for the entity, a fair return, and a fair price for the client, for the customer, and a fair return for the company, which is investing sometimes a lot of money, because we're talking about infrastructure, so it's usually a lot of money on the table. So that's the point. Which may to be too long.
So I'd just like to add to what Pascal had to say, and that is that as a regulated utility, we are subject to many regulations. We're subject to environmental regulations, for example. We're subject to reliability standards. That's another thing that we have to meet. There's lots of others, but what we're really talking about today is the regulation of the revenues that we receive. And I think that one of the things that we should focus on is that we have a legally enforceable right to collect those revenues once they have been approved by the regulator. It doesn't matter whether we collect them today, we collect them over the next couple of years, or we collect them over the next 30 years. We can go to court if we are not able to physically get our hands on the cash. We can go after the regulator, we can go after the customers. We have ways to collect that, and that should be a fundamental part of what we're looking at, whether we're looking at the conceptual framework or whether we're looking at something specific to rate-regulated entities.
Would you mind? I just wanted to ask Richard a question about that right to collect. Is the only mechanism via future revenue? And if it is, you know, future provision of services and adjustment of that revenue, and if it is, then what happens if the demand levels fall off so that the amount you're entitled to charge isn't recaptured because of volume shortfalls?
That's the question that gets asked all of the time when we try to deal with this. So what would happen if tomorrow electricity went away and we didn't need electricity? So my first response is that's very unlikely to happen.
Agreed.
But let's assume that it did. What would happen then? We have a situation where we have stranded assets. And so one of the things that we did while we were going through the transition to IFRS, and by the way, we are fully compliant with IFRS, and we still recognize our regulated assets and liabilities. And our auditors have accepted that.
Who are your auditors?
I think you might be. The question became, could we find any evidence of where something like that had happened in North America? So we didn't just look within Canada, we looked across North America. And frankly, we couldn't find any. The closest that I could come up with was a situation, and I actually wrote my MBA paper on this, and it was when I used to be the auditor for the government telephone company. And what happened was, when I first moved to Canada, Everything was owned by the telephone company. That included the wiring in your house and the telephones as well. And so you had to rent everything and you had to make a payment. And the government changed all of that, and they said that people could they could acquire their telephones from whoever, and the wiring would have to be done by the builder. And as a result of that, the telephone company had a large investment in those assets that were about to become stranded. And what happened in that case was they put a rate rider in place to recover that over the next 3 years. But I couldn't find any other examples of where it happened. So all that I can say is that the government would, or the regulator, but the regulator is a creature of the government, and so they would have to think about how they would deal with it. I mean, we recently had some devastating floods in Calgary. The government has no requirement to go out and help those homeowners, and there were thousands of them, to rebuild their houses, and yet they've come up and they've committed to doing it. I can't believe that the government would turn around and say you can't collect it, and I can tell you that the utilities would take them to court to be able to collect that money if electricity went away tomorrow.
PK.
Richard, that's very helpful. Just a curious question. What happens if you cease operations?
If we were to cease
operations... Mary's talking about demand falling, and yes, you're not able to collect from the pool of things. But if you cease operations, can your estate liquidator, whoever that is, can he go after the customers or can he go after regulator?
So if we as an entity ceased to operate and the demand was still there, then the regulator would appoint someone else to provide the service. So the service would continue, and whatever accounts we had created would continue as well. And an example of that is we've only been in business for 10 years. So the previous company that supplied the services, when they sold the assets to us, and remember, we didn't buy their business, we bought their assets and liabilities. Along with those assets and liabilities, we bought all of those deferral accounts that they had created over the years.
And you paid for that?
Oh, we paid for that. That was all part of the purchase price adjustment.
Casey, can I add a couple of additional examples? That I think Mary, I couldn't see your name tag, but you had a question.
No, that's okay. Please go ahead.
Okay.
So in Ontario, when the load drops within a particular service area, if you're in the middle of a rate proceeding, so through legal precedent in Canada, you would discover what the costs were to run the utility and to provide the service to the service area. If the load from one rate period to the other has declined, it simply means, all other things being equal, that the customer pays more. So I've sat on those types of rate cases where there has been an economic decline within a service area, 20% of the load disappears because it was large industrial, it's no longer economic and shut down. The costs do not disappear. The costs are simply reallocated amongst the remaining customers. And that, of course, puts other pressure on the utility to make sure that it's not over-investing, that it's being efficient. But from a rate perspective, we do not manage, or the regulator does not manage, the issue of... We manage the impact on the customer in the formation of rates, not in the determination of costs. If you had a low drop, the customers that remain would simply be on the hook to pay those costs. From a continuity perspective, the example that I think of in Ontario is with respect to a small Aboriginal utility that was not capable of running its affairs and has been under administration and being run by one of the larger, the dominant distributor in the province, and has been under an interim operating license now for a minimum of 4 years. I was at the board for 5.5 years. And through the entire period, the very small utility was operated and on a continuous basis by the dominant distributor. In terms of stranded assets, where you've had a structural change in the market, you probably want to look to FERC Order 636 in the United States in the early 1990s, where they decided to unbundle the price of natural gas from the transportation of that gas on an interstate basis, the gas prices plummeted with the introduction of market-based pricing, and the pipelines all had stranded fuel gas and gas for pressure.
They were allowed to recover the change
in market price. So I think there's any of a number of examples that demonstrate that the obligations created in the past with customers, they don't attach necessarily to a specific customer, but rather to pools of customers, and they are, I can't think of an example where they're not recovered, subject, of course, to the prudence. But again, that's very rare that they're not recovered.
Casey.
So I would, you know, Michael, you asked a question about the unit of account being the entity or the product, and I think in the U.S. we found that the unit of account of the product works quite well. You know, as Karen and Brian have alluded to, different components of the utility industry in the U.S. have been unbundled in different locations. So you might have a company that is fully cost-regulated for distribution, upstream to transmission, upstream to generation. You might have another company where the in a neighboring state where the generation, the commodity, has been unbundled and deregulated. And we've not struggled terribly with having a component of a business record regulatory assets and liabilities for that regulated piece and not for the unregulated piece. In fact, the wind company does that, you know, very, very widely. So I don't see that as an issue. I personally think about this as irreplaceability of the service. A commodity can be replaced, but the delivery may not because of the infrastructure requirement. So it's the captivity of the customer base, the irreplaceability of the service, to me provides that linkage. And then, you know, my final point would be, we have experienced a great deal of what we call decoupling regulation in the U.S. that seeks to disengage the volume of the service provided from the rates that customers pay. And the thought was that it was creating a disincentive to companies putting in energy efficiency measures, and that the regulators didn't want that disincentive. So they've decoupled volumes from the recovery mechanisms. And essentially, you're allowed to recover a dollar amount of revenue. And it is billed on a volumetric basis, but it is trued up in a very quick period of time after that measurement period back to the targeted revenue level. So while as an accommodation, future volumes are used for collection purposes, I don't think those future volumes are what's driving the recognition of the revenue or the collectability of the asset. It's merely done that way for billing purposes. And in fact, it's a separate line item on the bills. So you're getting charged your estimated cost for this time period plus a true up from the previous time period. And it's, you might have a different owner of those different cash flows, right? They could go to a different entity, and that's not uncommon for us to see either.
Okay. Thank you.
I think that in my opinion, the important thing is the certainty, and that, and it derives from some conditions. One of them is the monopoly, or if the entity is a monopoly. The other thing is whether the entity operates in the necessary utility market. And I agree with Pascal about the distinction of FERC-regulated field against the retro-regulated entity. I think it's very important to concentrate about the retro-regulation entities and not the fields that are retro-regulated for other purposes. In Israel, the electricity company, for example, is regulated by about 15 regulators, but only one of them is important for the discussion here. Which is the rate regulator.
Okay. Pascal? Yes, I have two comments. I would say that for me, the risk of demand is not a reason not to recognize an asset. So we have billions of merchant power plants on our balance sheet, and we have the risk of demand, so that's why we book sometimes some impairment losses, so because we have a decrease in cash flow, so not a reason not to book an asset. So I don't really understand. That's not the first time I heard the question, but I don't understand why it would be a reason not to recognize any assets and liabilities. That's my first comment. Second comment is that for the regulator, and as far as I know for France, there is no difference between, I would say, CAPEX or rate asset, regulated asset, what we call regulated asset based, and OPEX. Tariff is made of both components, and really for them there is no difference in both. So, and that's why it's maybe it's a difference from other businesses which are not regulated, because for other businesses, of course, we have the assets, I would say, power plants on the balance sheet, but we do not defer any OPEX, because some OPEX or expenses are considered as period expenses. So maybe that's a difference between of the rate regulation, that we have some right to recover some expenses which are part of the tariff. But it's also because of the rate regulation mechanism, but we have also, as I say, I agree with you, the point is that we have in France, for example, we have authorized revenues, and we may have it's a fixed amount, and this fixed amount is based on a forecast volume, and we could have authorized revenue of 100, and some years we could be 120 because the volume is higher, because for example for gas business, when it's very cold in December, that's maybe simple that when we, so we, volume is increasing, so we build more in 1 year because of the climate. So, but as we are limited in revenue because we have authorized revenue, so we build over 20 and we have to give it back through the tariff. And some years, if not, the climate is different, so we will build 80, and but we have to recover 20, the difference. And after, what is, I think, difficult to have a general standard, because each regulation is different. We, about time, this timing difference, we have part of this timing difference just rolling over during the tariff period, and maybe we will may end up with one remaining balance at one end of period. So, and again, it's a discussion with the regulator to how we will recover this asset, or how we will pay this liability. But I think what is key is in our business is that it's, the business is authorized revenue, and we could have liability because we were not entitled to make more profit when business is, when the weather is bad for us. But we sell more gas when the weather is bad, and it's a profit because we merchant. It's a merchant business. In the regulated business, we're not merchant, so we're not authorized to make more profit because of the bad weather. That it works. Leonardo.
I agree with Richard when he said about the legal right to collect the amount of the regulatory assets. For me, it's very crucial. In our country, for instance, the possibility to recover to collect the regulatory assets on the next rate adjustment is very high. I believe it's very similar in Canada or in other countries. But even if I don't receive the full amount, let's say that I don't receive 5% or 10% of the amount, I can include this residual value in the next rate adjustment. So it's, we can say that I always will receive that asset. So I can say that this asset is safer, is no problem that I will receive the full amount when I compare to my accounts receivable, for instance. Okay.
Brian.
Thank you. I just want to make a couple comments. I agree with Richard's comments, and I get back to the stranded assets for a moment, particularly as a regulator, when that revenue is authorized, we work very hard to make sure they get it. We look through our records to try to see if there was a case where some of the examples that was raised around the table, and we could not find one other than the case of the take-or-pay contracts when the commission unbundled the gas industry in the United States under Order 636. That was a pretty good deal for the customers and also for the companies, because what happened in that case, those stranded assets actually were picked up from the future customers. They were allowed to defer those, and maybe they have taken a hit. Maybe they didn't get 100%. Those amounts were not deferred. We required them to write those off. But the ones that were allowed to be deferred, they were entitled to collect those revenues associated with those deferrals. As to whether a supplier leaves a service territory, we deliberate over several rate proceedings whereby the demand has changed. And as the young lady said, for Canada, that does go flow through to the other customers, maybe through some higher rates for a temporary period of time. So I do think once the revenues are authorized, they very seriously, the regulator that sets that rate, try to ensure that they collect that money. And I haven't seen a case where they haven't.
Thank you. Tim.
Just to offer a lender's perspective, I guess, and, you know, confine my remarks to what we've done in the past, but to elaborate on Brian's comment or Richard's comment earlier than that, I mean, these amounts that have been put into a deferral account and there's the legal right to recover them and et cetera, that those amounts are bankable. We do lend against those amounts, so whether it's money spent to recover after a hurricane or money spent to rebuild a transmission system after a big winter storm, these are amounts that we don't, you know, we do our analysis, we do our due diligence, but, you know, the when they say that it's collectible against the rate base and it's been the subject of a rate proceeding, that's generally been good enough for us. Would you prefer the rate base is a larger rate base than the smaller rate base in the service territory? Yeah, sure. Would you prefer that it's a 2-year deferral rather than a 5-year deferral? Yeah, that's true as well. But generally speaking, as a principle, these amounts are monies that are going to be recovered and we can lend against.
Heather, Mary?
A question for Tim on that. Do you make any distinction in your lending analysis between amounts that have been through a
rate
proceeding? Versus, I understand from some of the RFI, I think the RFI responses, maybe some of the other information, that and there might be costs that are incurred that are similar to ones that have been allowed in the past, and those also will be accumulated in a variance account, but are subject to review and approval by the regulator after the fact rather than before the fact. Do you make any kind of distinction in your analysis?
I think you'd prefer to have it specifically blessed.
Mm-hmm.
Again, case by case, which is kind of a cop-out to the question, but we would look at it case by case. You'd prefer something explicit from the regulator, but again, if the customer in question can point to past practice and, you know, whether it's, look, this is a prudent cost, it's been allowed in the past, and depending on the amount of money in question, you might be able to get your head around it.
So do you ask for that kind of segregation and have different discussions?
I think that's part of our analysis, which is you drill down into all aspects of the recoverability and what kind of approvals you have in place and the likelihood that, you know, it isn't recoverable or any... Not the likelihood of unrecoverability, but the chance that you could be surprised. You want to eliminate all unpleasant surprises.
New concept.
Can I just add to Tim's answer? So most of the rates in Canada are set on a forward test year basis. So going into the fiscal year, amounts that are not typically priced into the revenue requirement, if they are significant and the utility makes the case, they can get a variance account established for deviations for the particular cost item that's allowed in rates. If there is an item that is in rates, but there is expected to be some variability to that amount, the regulator will set up the deferral account and define an accounting order, as it would with the variance account, on how monies are to be collected in that account. So they do it typically on a forward test year basis, so you know what balances and variances can go into those accounts. And that tends to reduce the difficulties Mary's getting at, which is the recognition and reliance on those amounts. So you know on a forward test year basis, which again, the vast majority of Canadian utilities are regulated on that basis, you know going into your test year, assuming these things are timely, that certain types of balances, assuming you follow the order of the board or the commission, you can put those amounts in with relative certainty.
Casey and then Brian.
Yeah, I might just build on what Tim discussed, in that we do frequently see securitization lending on separable regulatory assets, yeah, typically with a separate tariff. But it's not. We have also seen outright sales of those tariffs. Oftentimes, for accounting purposes, under U.S. GAAP, it's accounted for as a loan, but the legal documents refer to it as a sale. And I am aware of instances where, for accounting purposes, it's been accounted for a sale as well as it, rather than a loan. So, typically, Mayor, to answer your question, it is a cost that had been deferred, has gone through a rate proceeding, has a specific tariff assigned to it, and the cash flows attributable to that tariff can be sold. And they may be collected over 2 years, they may be collected over 5 years. In the example of Hurricane Katrina, where the repair costs were in the billions of dollars, some of the jurisdictions provided for 10-year recovery of those costs, and those regulatory assets were in fact sold. So there is separability, and at least in the U.S. legal environment, a right of control to the extent that they can be sold.
Mary, I thought you asked a very good question, whether the regulatory assets is pursuant to a regulatory proceeding or not. One of the things we do at the Commission, regulatory assets get a lot of scrutiny from us, and not just the ones that does not have a particular rate proceeding, but the ones that does too. And on audit, I can remember a time when the company was booking a regulatory asset, and I was the director of audits at this particular point, and it was like $95 million, but they had not come in for a rate proceeding for 4 or 5 trips down the road when they could have came in. We made them write it off. So even as a regulator, we look at these regulatory assets to test that probability, whether they're going to come in for get a rate proceeding or whether there's a rate action in the past that would support that. So I just want to offer that I do see some problems sometimes with regulatory assets that does not have that specific proceeding from the commission.
PK and then Dennis.
Thanks. This is extremely helpful to me. Wanted to understand two questions. I know this discussion has been pretty much moving towards utilities, but I want to understand in other industries what's happening. Maybe Tim, maybe you can give it, if you have experience in lending money in industries other than utilities, granted they are the biggest and the most need of capital intensive, but what about other industries? Do you have any experience there, and what is the process that you are aware of? Because we don't want to make it a utility-specific standard, but we want to find out common themes so that we can get a scoping properly.
I mean, again, no experience in sugar or flour or
cemeteries
for advisory, taxi companies, anything that would have been responded to the RFI, but one that did, who are also a client of mine, is the provider of air navigation services in Canada, Nav Canada. And again, they're a non-share capital corporation, so they run a reserve fund, and again, they adjust their rates that they charge airlines who use our airspace in Canada up or down, depending on their ability to meet their obligations and prudentially cover for debt service and other things. So they're actually a double A rated entity. This ability to recover those costs is, if bankable is the word I used before, it's very bankable. They're very conservative and prudent in how they run their business. So that would be another industry where we would, and other banks in Canada would, fund their requirements. There's less of a deferral account kind of example. I don't think there is a deferral account example with that client because it's not, suffering kind of the slings and arrows of weather or other issues. But again, there are years where the rates have to go up and the users pay them. There are rate years where rates go down and, the users get a rebate kind of thing. It doesn't have to be a utility. We do have examples in my portfolio where it works. I don't know if that answered the question.
It does. I just want to see what is the common theme that wants to bring it into the scope. So if the rate regulatory mechanism, because I think somebody said it well, we don't want to have a telecommunication or a debit card fee that is set by a regulator, market regulator, but that doesn't come into the scope, but some mechanism to recover any shortfalls or any overages that you need to return. That's the second step we need to think about to see to bring it into scope, at least in my mind. Not just some market mechanism setting the rate, but if there is a shortfall or more, how do you recover those costs? So that's the mechanism that I'm at least mentally thinking about. Okay. Utilities is one common example you can think of, but what about other industries?
In that particular example, it's got the same kind of characteristics where it's a monopoly provider, and they're being judged or marked on their prudently running their business and not exploiting the fact that they've got the ability to adjust rates. So it's kind of similar to a utility in a lot of ways.
Tim, are you also involved with BC Ferries in Canada? It's very similar. It's the ferry between the Vancouver Island and the continent. I think they're also regulated. It's a monopoly. They're acting exactly as any other gas electricity companies. They're allowed to recover certain costs. If they're not recovered, they're going to get in front of the regulator and get, an increase or decrease.
Not with BC Ferries, but Michelle, another example is any kind of airport authority in Canada where it's not necessarily a regulator on the other side that's pushing back on what they're doing, but it's the fact that it's the airline community which is facing unique and different problems of their own, but they're ultimately the guys who pay the landing fees, the guy who pays the terminal link fees, and there's significant pressure put on these guys to, as the monopoly provider of the air terminal and other services, to behave themselves in terms of what they charge airlines. So kind of similar, and I think the ferry example is the same.
Yeah. PK, I've got when you talk about the sugar that could be regulated or any other product, I'm fine with that, but is that the issue? What the fact that it's regulated, it still doesn't create an asset. And I think in the sugar industry, they will say, I'll fix the price at two, and later on, you can charge me the rest. I don't think it says that here. The regulator says, it's fixed the price, and I will allow you, and the cost of service and the incentive base, I think it's all the same. You fix the price, you're supposed to recover your cost. We're not supposed to make bankrupt because, it's an important product, service. And then if having incurred costs that were not anticipated will allow you to recover it. But I don't think the sugar industry will tell you that, isn't it? You know, whether her products, we say, you know, could be regulated, whether it's going to be the telco or not, at the end, what the important thing is not the fact that you only regulated it. Somebody is going to tell you, okay, that cost that was not anticipated will allow you to recover it in the future. And because we're talking about stability rate, obviously they're not telling you go back and recover it in the past, or retrospectively will allow you to recover it over a certain period of time. The issue is that it's the rate stability that does not allow us to recover it retrospectively. So for me, the regulation is one thing, but it's also the regulator that allows you to recover something, gives you an order to charge it in the future. Yeah, I think to me that's the important thing. It's not the regulation itself.
That's an important point, because I was thinking in the airline example that Tim was talking, it is between the airport authority and the airlines. It's between the customer and the provider.
Right.
There's nobody in between. Will that be in or out? I don't know the answer to it, and I don't think the purpose is to make that. But I was just thinking in the example that you talked in the airport authority, there is no regulator. I go to my customers and say, hey guys, I fell short. What do you do? So that becomes a customer. It's what the market can absorb and what market can pay kind of a thing. So
yeah,
I don't know what happens in that situation.
But the customer into the NAV Canada, they're acting as a governing board.
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the Vancouver airport or the Toronto airport, where the landing fees is dictated by the airport authority to the airline.
PK, we have a specific paper that comes later with questions about do we need a regulator. So we'll come back to this decision, if you don't mind. Dennis?
I was going to add a lot of what you was just saying. In when we audit these companies, we're looking for this interaction. We're experiencing this dialogue, the interaction between the regulator and the company, and the regulator ultimately deciding the ability to recover that. And we talked about stranded costs, and he even mentioned we didn't let them keep those on the balance sheet. We made them write them off. And so it's that theme that's the interaction and the authorization of the recovery of these costs that exist in the accounting that's acceptable. And your example of the roaming rates that are used by telecom, that's set, as Pascal said, more as a market cap as opposed to an action to recover the cost. And I would not expect any of the telecom in Europe are recording any assets as associated with that plan. That's just the price they charge for roaming. So in our world, we look, as McKeel said, pretty aggressively to how do you support that asset? Well, let's see what the regulator said, and are they authorizing you to recover that in your future rate? So the theme we see is this interaction by a body who has the statutory authority to set the rates and decide if the cost can really be recovered through the future billing of services.
Casey?
Yeah, I coincidentally used to audit a death care company. And since you mentioned it, I thought I could just make some comment. Highly regulated industry, to the extent that the regulators even have capital requirements that they have to maintain, because you know you have to maintain a cemetery into perpetuity, requirements to segregate funds, even some oversight over pricing. But you know, Michelle, as you mentioned, there's a competitive element to it and no guarantee of collecting the money necessary to maintain that cemetery in perpetuity, only requirements that the owners put in equity, not that the customers or others or the public pay for it. So while highly regulated and even price controlled to some extent, it's not an irreplaceable service. It's a competitive service. So it's interesting that there was a paper submitted.
Cases?
Yes, I think financing is also a question that is very interesting to analyze the features of regulated activities. And as you were asking about financing, as in the case, of, for example, of transport infrastructure assets, let's say toll roads or airports, normally the banks are financing these assets considering their right. They had the right they had to recover the investment through future revenue. It's regulated. So you analyze, for example, which is the capacity to raise a loan from a toll road or from an airport, normally if in a normal company you had 3 times EBITDA, you analyze a dollar roll, you had 10 times, 9 times, because it's related with the right you have, the right that you have to recover the investment you had made with future revenue that is established by the regulator. Or for example, in the case of an airport, normally the capacity of raising financing is related with the regulated, because the regulated asset base is finally is the asset that used by the regulator to establish the tariffs. So, and also it means the capacity to generate revenue from the airport. So that regulated asset base is the base that is used by the financiers to this asset. And you say normally an airport had had 0.8 of the regulated asset base as a level of financing. So the question is, financing is so related, and the banks are financing taking in mind these assets and the rights they have related with these assets.
But in the toll road example, is it the right to recover tolls, or is it the analysis that you've done on the traffic risk, which says that traffic will be there?
Well, you have a traffic risk, but in any case, you are making an investment initially, and the question is that you have tariffs, that tariffs are for 20, 30 years, that are established to recover that asset. And the question here is, I think it's very similar to our discussion. We have a monopoly, or there is no competition. And another question, that the tariffs are fixed in order that the toll road operator obtain a fair rate of return. And the question that in the initial years, you are not obtaining the fair rate of return, because normally the tariffs are established taking in mind the concerns of the customers. For example, if you have a toll road and you have a tariff that is increased every year 10%, that's a regulation decision that has impact in the financial statements of the company. And the question is, we understand here we have also a regulation, because as the tariffs are fixed by a regulator, the profitability of the company is affected by that. And we understand that the analysis has to be to take in mind this global rate of return, that is the fair rate of return that is established by the regulator.
Just structure question. In your example of toll roads or other industries where the tariff is fixed to ensure a fair rate of return, are there variance specific cost or revenue volume variance accounts established, or is how is the expectation versus the actual captured and considered in terms of tariff reviews?
Well, that's a question that normally, I think that's an interesting question, because somebody can think that regulation is only applied when there is a deviation. But you say, no, I had a deviation and then I had a right. My question is, you have an initial investment and you have a regulation related with that initial investment. So you have demand risks, and the discussion, as Pascal said, demand risk here is not the issue to recognize an asset. The question is that you had a regulated tariff and you had to obtain a fair rate of return. Really, there is the relation between the tariffs and the rate of return is not fair, because normally, for example, it's in the case of an airport, you make an investment in an airport and you say, according with the regulatory position of the regulator, you have to obtain a cost of capital of 8%. But the tariffs will not increase according with the inflation. Will increase first year 10% plus inflation, second year 30% plus inflation, and the last year is less 10% plus inflation. So your profit and loss account is affected by that type of tariffs. But at the end of the day, you have a rate of return that has been established by the regulator. That is, the cost of capital in this case is 7 or 7%. And that's the question. And probably you can have demand risks. And if you had a change, for example, if you had less users than expected, you had to consider this in the financial statement of the company. But my question is, you can recognize a regulatory asset although you had demand risks.
But let's say the target rate of return that was the basis for your 10% plus CPI, 30%, the pricing structure that's agreed?
But the pricing structure is not fixed to is fixed, taking in mind the concerns of the customers.
Right. So if that pricing structure is set to give a fair rate of return, and that rate of return is either not achieved or overachieved because of cost variances, how is that captured and considered in subsequent, you know, is there a subsequent review of tariffs?
Yes, that's, for example, in the case of airports, here in the UK, you had a review of the regulation every 5 years. So, if, for example, you had more OPEX than expected, the OPEX you had incurred during the last 5 years is an expense that is on your side. You will not obtain compensation for that deviation of OPEX, but the new level of OPEX will be considered for the regulation of the next 5 years.
I just want to go back to Tim's examples with the funding, because I was thinking about Pascal's discussion about regulating markets and things. I actually think it's very helpful to think about the incentives and differences between whether you are trying
Sorry, to... Sorry, I can't hear you.
Whether you're trying to secure supply, for example, in which case, to me, that's where you are. You have the right to get charged these amounts, as opposed to the situations where you do have a monopoly, where, if anything, even though they sound like guaranteed returns, if anything, the incentives to try and cap the returns so that the people are not making monopolies. So I have no doubt at all that in the case of an airport authority, they have something very valuable there. But it's the same thing in any sort of anybody who's got a very good infrastructure. You can lend against future sales. I mean, I've seen lots of lending agreements against future sales. It's something valuable. It doesn't mean we count it as an asset. And I think it's helpful to distinguish between the right to charge something and the ability. I think of the ability as more like the monopoly situations. This might not be very helpful, but I was telling Jane a while ago, I actually know of one successful case where a company fought to get a return, reasonable return on their assets, and because of the way the contract was written, successfully argued that they were entitled to a monopoly return. Because when the government had basically sold off these telecommunications assets, it failed to limit what assets it could get a return on. So they argued the monopoly value was actually an asset. So they were able to generate these huge returns. Government instead didn't break them up. But there's a difference between the right and ability. And I'm wondering whether that's something that others think about here, because I think you can look at two regulations. As I say, one's to get people in there, to guarantee that they'll be in there, secure supply, so they give them the right to keep them there. And the other one is they exist in a very important sector, even in air traffic control or airports, but others would love to get in there, but they can't, because they've essentially got such strong infrastructure that people can't chip away at it. So you want to try and cap them. And they look the same in many cases, but one, to me, is a right, and one's the ability. And if we're going to differentiate between different things, I'd like to know if that's a helpful way of thinking about it.
Tim?
Just to comment on the toll road example just a little bit more. There's the demand risk piece of it, which is out there, which makes it a little different, but there's also kind of a distinguishing factor, which might be the essential service nature of a utility or anybody who's been granted a monopoly, so certainly in Canada with an airport authority or the air navigation service, versus a toll road concession owner who, unlikely to happen as it may be, runs the risk of setting prices so high that people use alternatives. There's no monopoly given to a toll road operator. Clearly it's in his interest to operate and control costs and price his tolls so that people use the toll road, but again, there's no legislative monopoly, or certainly in the cases that I'm familiar with in my country.
But it depends country from country.
Yep.
For example, we have in Toronto the ETR 407, and in this case the tariffs are free. So the decision to increase the tariffs depends on the operator and depends on the level of traffic. You can increase the tariff if the level of traffic is over a threshold. But this is not the normal case. In other countries, normally the tariffs are fixed by the government. For example, we had that road in Chicago where the tariffs are fixed by the government of the city. And we had increases that is first year 1%, next year 3%, and 5 years 17%, and then 10%. So they are considering, in order to fix the prices, customers. And this is a regulation because it's established by the concession authority. So depending on the countries, in some countries, you have the example of the 407, that is free. But normally, the prices are fixed by the government. And really, it's near to a monopoly. It's possible to build a parallel road. It's not affordable. Normally, you have a road, say, in Spain from Madrid to Barcelona. You have only one road, and if this is a toll road, you have to pay a tariff. And this is a monopoly, so we need regulation to fix the tariffs, because in any case, it will be very profitable for the owner of the toll road.
Michelle?
Can I add a little something? Sorry, I can't see when name tags are up, and I don't have one.
Okay.
In Canada, when we look at rate-regulated entities, we typically have a situation and this comes back to this notion of a right versus an ability. The contractual toll road example, the 407 in Ontario, that would be more of an ability within a contract. It's not, it doesn't have the two characteristics that the rest of the rate-regulated entities that I'm aware of in Canada have. And first one is this notion of a market failure or the presence of a natural monopoly. So 407 is one of a number of large highways that people can drive on, and it is therefore subject to any of a number of pressures with respect to tolls. The second factor that we have for most utilities that I'm aware of is that the notion that sunk costs are fixed, and therefore the markets that they serve are not truly contestable in the situation where you can't just take the asset, take it out of the ground, and move it. So I would differentiate, for example, transmission utilities, gas and electric, distribution utilities, gas and electric, from BC Ferries, where at the end of the day, if that's a money-losing proposition and the government has no other social objectives to keep the thing in operation, you close it down and you take the ferries to a different part of the world. The fixed costs are not sunk. They can be redeployed. That is not the case with pipelines or any other energy utility asset, such as a big nuclear plant, which we do regulate in Ontario, and therefore all of these special requirements. But I think we really need to focus on those two types of characteristics, as well as this notion of a right as opposed to an ability. An ability would be more of a contractual relationship. The right, at least as far as I'm concerned, once a regulator says you're allowed to collect that rate, as the gentleman from the FERC said earlier, the regulator is going to work pretty hard to make sure that you get that collection.
Michelle, then Richard, and then it's time for our break.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment on the reasonable rate of return. My recollection that Canada does not have a rate of return. It has only a right to collect its cost. And there's also one utility, electricity distribution company in New Brunswick, they only have a right to recover their costs. They have no rate of return. So rate of return is not, for me, an important factor here to decide.
Richard?
I just wanted to respond to Alan's point on the legal right versus the ability. In our case, we recovered, just as most utilities do, something called allowance for funds used during construction. So we capitalized that, and we recovered that over the average life of the assets, which is anywhere from 30 to 35 years. And so people have questioned whether those particular items should be included in our financial statements. At the moment, we have special dispensation from our regulator that we actually recover that in the current year. So instead of recovering it over 30 years, we're getting it in the next 12-month period. So it's exactly the same. We calculate it the same way. It's the same amount. The only difference is the timing. So why should we recognize it because we get it this year and not recognize it over 30 years? That, to me, is a question of measurement, not a question of recognition.
Thank you. So we're going to take a short break. Can I ask you to come back by 11:15? 16 something. 20 past.
Okay.
There's no time.
There's no time.
I think the discussion has
lasted. John, in Australia, are you still on the line?
Yes, I am. Okay. Yeah, I'm still on the line.
Okay. I hope you would have just jumped in if you had something to say.
No, it was very useful. That was good to hear that commentary and that discussion.
Okay, that's great. Thanks.
Which hotel was it?